It's Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, your host, and it is my job to welcome to the program Wealth Enhancement Group's Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor, Peg Webb, with a special guest. And Peg, I understand Bruce is off today. How are you?
Yes, we're giving him a day off here at the year end. He's put in his time for 2024.
Okay, good, good. Hopefully you can get some time off too.
Yes, I think I do my fair share.
Okay,
Susie,
very good. Yes. What are we talking about today?
Well, today we actually have a special guest. And what I'd like to do is have people call in after I introduce Matthew, 651-461-9226, because it's rare that we bring one of our top investment people on the show. So welcome, everyone, to our show. Today, we're actually going to focus on a year-end review of 2024. And then, I think more importantly, the market trends that we think are coming, what perspectives do we have as a company and our investment team, what do we think lies ahead? So I'm pleased to announce that we are welcoming Matthew Parks to help us interpret what's going on in the financial markets. Well, let me tell you a little bit about Matthew. He joined Wealth Enhancement Group's roundtable on the investment team. He's one of our portfolio consultants. He works out of our Orlando, Florida office. His role is to work directly with advisors and their clients because he actually helps build these custom investment solutions for clients because a lot of people have unique objectives. He's always had a passion for investments, and I love this part about Matthew. When he could first read financial reports, and he thought it was his favorite company, and it was Toys R Us, which I actually think is kind of appropriate since we're at the holiday season. I've got a little granddaughter, and she loves all those toys. But he graduated from the University of Florida with a dual major in finance and economics, and then since college, he's gained years of experience with investment firms. He's been an investment manager, an analyst, a portfolio manager, and the head of a trading desk. And here's the hard part that Matthew has done. He actually has these professional designations, which are Certified Financial Analyst, CFA, and a Chartered Market Technical Person. Well, welcome, Matthew, and I'm so glad that you're on our roundtable when it comes to our invest team.
Well, thank you very much. I'm excited to be here.
So I thought what we would do is we would just start talking about 2024. I know we're very near the end here, but after the markets had climbed, but then there was kind of a wall of worry. Then we had the post-election market rally, and there's just strong economic growth driving these stocks and other risk assets. But what are some of the challenges that we had this year? Maybe you could just kind of recap, and then we'll eventually get into our perspective on 2025. Matthew?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. Yeah, it's been a really strong year. It ended up being a really strong year for equity markets. You know, as of Friday's close, the S&P 500 year to date is up just a little over 24%. And one of the consistent trends that we've seen is the growth in the equity market up until recently, until November, has been really in the large cap names. You know, the largest companies were driving this market. You know, and you think it's all the household names, Apple, Amazon, Nvidia, which has had a stellar year driving the names. But one of the, you know, key, pretty consistent tenets is possible uncertainty. And, you know, the fear of the unknown is always top of mind, whether it's political risk. I know the war in Ukraine drives on and has really weighed on developed international markets. You know, the ongoing threat of tariffs in the United States, what does that look like for inflation, for employment? You know, at the end of the day, where we're going to see inflation back up at 9%, like it was following COVID, you know, in the pandemic. And so the ongoing potential for uncertainty has just been a consistent message. But throughout the entire year, we've seen that none of the talked about uncertainty has really played out. And has ended up leading to a very strong year for equities across the board, Peg.
Yeah, Mike, I have to tell you that the clients are actually very happy. My friends are happy. My neighbors are happy that all the equity markets have done well. And how about fixed income? Let's give a little recap about interest rates.
Yeah, so the interest rates are going to be largely controlled by the Federal Reserve. And what they do is, when times are tough, you know, they're going to lower interest rates. And when times are, you know, going really well, or to combat inflation, they raise them. So following the spike in inflation, when the money supply expanded after, 2021 legislation, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates above where they'd been previously for a pretty long historical period and faster than any point in history. But ever since then, inflation's come down, and because of that, interest rates have come down gradually as well. And so because of the fixed income market, the market price of bonds that you would see in your account has just gradually gone up. It's been a really strong year for the fixed income market. Now, we have seen a slight tick up in interest rates following, say, October or so is really the bottom of the interest rates. So as of the past couple months, we've seen, you know, the market value of bonds drop down, but that offers a really great position and opportunity to buy in and build interest, you know, your fixed income allocation, and take advantage of interest rates that are really above where they were just a month or two ago. And one of the key really important things to consider is the difference between in yield between, say, the 10-year and the 2-year, which, you know, everybody on market coverage in the news would say, you know, the yield curve is inverted. And that's what that means, that the 10-year yield on treasuries is below the 2-year yield, which is pretty atypical. But right now what we're seeing is the interest rates across every year duration is pretty flat. So as far as a financial planning and perspective, it's a great opportunity. You can build out treasury ladders or fix, you know, your fixed income allocation across the board and have pretty consistent cash flow and coupon and interest yield at every duration there. Thanks.
What do you mean by ladder? Can you just tell the audience? Because I don't think we've talked about that on the show recently.
Yeah, absolutely. So ladder would be is just pairing a bunch of individual bonds together at multiple durations. So you'd buy a bond that matures in a year and another one in 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. And so that each year you're getting cash flow from the bonds that are maturing, but you have an entire number of other bonds that are generating income through their coupon and interest payments. And from a financial planning perspective, it's really nice because it gives you a little bit of certainty in investments, knowing what to count on roughly as far as what the cash flows be, and when the bonds reach maturity, what the cash flow is going to be that you can use to spend or reinvest when they come due. So that would be from a planning side. Yeah.
I love that strategy. And I think we haven't talked about that for a while. And bonds are less understood than the stock market as a whole when we work with our clients. So I'm glad that you explained that to them. Let's go outside the United States a little bit and talk about the global markets.
Yeah, absolutely. So the contrast in performance has been pretty stark this year. If we look and discuss, the S&P 500 is up 24% year to date. If we look at MSCI's EAFE, which is just an index of equities of developed markets outside of the U.S., that number drops down to 2.8%. So the performance outside the United States has been very lackluster, especially when you compare it to really the strong performance in the United States. And that's really driven by a number of things. When you look at, say, the business sentiment and conditions in other developed nations, they're not as business friendly as the expectations of the United States. there's an added layer of political risk that now doesn't seem to be the sentiment for the United States. And on top of that, some of the tech giants that are here in the United States are the leaders in growth compared to the outside of the U.S. Now, when looking at international markets, we have seen emerging markets hurt also by a strong dollar. And so as far as where we see the strength, those international names may provide diversification, but if you look at the top names in the S&P 500, today's world is kind of inherently global. 49% of their revenue comes from international markets. So it's tough to make an argument anymore for taking an investment approach that is purely international developed markets when the performance hasn't been there. And that's not to say that it won't be there. There will always be times where one market performs better than the other. And in the long run, they've pretty well tracked each other. But what we're seeing is a rise in animal spirits or, you know, excitement for the United States and kind of a piling amount of uncertainty or possible risks for international. So that's kind of the picture that we're seeing right now, Peg.
I've always had clients that really weren't comfortable with international. I feel like because it wasn't close enough to home. And so I've always struggled in my career with clients about adding international. But I'm so glad you brought up the fact that 49% of the companies that are in the United States do business around the world. And that's what I would explain to my clients too. And they went, oh, seriously? Then do I need to layer on even more international than I already have? So thank you for bringing that up. So 2024, now that's the past. And once again, clients are happy. Probably people listening today are happy with how their statements look. But now there seems to be a little bit of concern. We're going into a new year. What do we foresee the economy doing in the markets?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the points that I was digging through data this morning to get an idea of, if you remember in 2016 when, you know, there was gangbuster growth in GDP, and the beginning of 2016, the real GDP growth rate was around 1.5%. By 2018, it had surged to 3.3 or so percent. Today, real GDP is sitting at 2.7% year-over-year growth. So we're going into 2025, really strong economic growth. And with business sentiment surveys showing that small and mid-cap businesses are sharing now in the excitement, there does seem to be kind of a overarching optimism for 2025. Now, there are obviously concerns with looking ahead here. No one knows what's going to happen. No, we don't know what possible trade tariffs are going to be. But if we look back at other rhetoric from Trump's presidency, it's the number of trade wars or tariffs that were actually enacted were far less than what, you know, we saw as headlines in the news. So it's, again, it's this story of possible certainty that may not actually come true. But yet this time is so different that we're going into the year with really strong economic conditions. And on top of that, inflation has dropped from a high of, say, 9% or so, all the way down to, we're looking at 2.7 on one of the latest surveys. So we're also going into it with lower inflation, and inflation that's not really growing or ticking up.
So what we should do is, I just want to make sure that people are listening today, that they might want to call in or text in, because I would love for you to have some questions, since you're the Roundtable Investment Team's expert. And so 651-461-9226, text or the contact the studio line by calling. So we want to get those set up, because at the half of the hour, we're going to take your questions. When you talk about going into 2025, is there some type of gotcha? Like, what would you say would be top of mind, Matthew?
Yeah, there's really two big things. It is the political tensions, whether what we expect versus what may come true. I think the really big elephant in the room is what happens with interest rates. So if we look back at historical projections of what the Federal Reserve fund interest rates would be today, they were saying interest rates should be around 2 to 2.5%. Now they're at forward-looking economic projections for interest rates are saying maybe 3%. And in fact, they don't expect to start cutting rates as quickly as the market had priced in just a couple quarters ago. So when the Fed cuts interest rates, that is a huge lift for equity markets. And you would see fixed income prices go up. Now, you may not get as much yield on your fixed income products that you purchase in the future, but your fixed income and bond portfolio would see a big lift. So if the Federal Reserve doesn't cut rates at a pace that the market expected going into 2025, that's going to be a little bit of headwind to the overall excitement for equities. And then that's a little more of a quantitative risk. And then as far as the political risk, there's your guess would be as good as mine. I mean, we have the information on what's happening now and what the proposals are, and we can run the analysis on roughly what the market's reaction be to different outcomes based on, you know, numerous historical data and studies. But as far as political risk is always the question of what's projected versus what will actually come true. So in that regards, you know, it's a kind of a wait and see, but we do see discussions on trade tariffs and different fiscal policies as far as what would be coming through the pipelines or different efficiency measures. So in that area, there's a lot going on and a lot to look at there, Peg.
Well, I always said on my desk, I have an actual crystal ball. And the reason I have it on my desk is because when clients come in and we do their reviews, I say, okay, look at my crystal ball. And it's always kind of fuzzy, right? We never really know. But what we do have to do is follow your risk and your objectives. And, you know, if you're uncomfortable, now is kind of having the time to meet with your advisor or talk to them, because there are a lot of things that could happen. Not that that isn't how history has been. The coulda, shoulda, woulda. Sometimes you wish you did. Sometimes you wish you didn't. But it's important that your portfolio is diversified. And I like what you said about the stock market, and there is some excitement there. But yet, personally, you have to make sure that you look at your goals, objectives, and what's important to you. And maybe just, you know, take a good deep look at it before the end of the year. The other thing I wanted to plug in before we go to the break is taxes. And taxes have been very busy this year, but we've made a lot of profits in our accounts. And, you know, it might be time to take some of those capital gains. Not that you want to maybe leave the market, but you could take your gains and then go buy something that's similar in the markets. If it's dissimilar to what you sold. And so that might be a good idea as well. So on the back side of this, we're going to actually just look at what are some of the clear things that we believe the economy is going to do? What is Wealth Enhancement Group thinking overall? Are we changing our portfolios? You know, things like that. But what I'd like to do is have listeners call in 651-461-9226, because I believe having Matthew in house right now and to answer your real live questions would be great. And you can either text or call the studio line. Susie.
All right. As you heard Peg say, 651-461-9226. It is your money. Wealth Enhancement Group, a very special guest on the ready to answer your questions. And we do have a couple of questions in. We will just tell you guys, you and Matt, before we get started into the break, just a couple of the things we're hearing from listeners right now, just to kind of ready both of you as we come back on the other side of the show. This person writes, I have a nice gain on a stock. If I sell, do I have to wait 30 days before I buy it back? That's a question to ponder. This person writes, does history indicate a best time during the year to rebalance a stock portfolio? Susie, ask Peg if this gentleman, he can talk about the challenges with government challenges in France, Germany, and China's economy. So we'll get to those questions, and we invite yours too. If you're sitting on the sidelines this morning wondering about the stock market, maybe you have money in it, maybe you don't, and you want to get into the stock market, we'll get to your questions at 651-461-9226 right after this short break. It is Your Money. Welcome to the second half of the program. I'm going to reintroduce to you Peg Webb, Senior Financial Advisor with Wealth Enhancement, with a very special guest today. Peg, take it away.
Yes, today we have Matthew Parks, part of our Wealth Enhancement Roundtable, and he's on our investment team. He's one of our portfolio consultants. So glad to have him. His role is to work directly with advisors and their clients, and he helps build custom investment solutions based on clients' unique objectives. He's always been passionate about investing, and he actually graduated from the University of Florida with a dual major in finance and economics. Smart guy. Since college, he has gained a lot of experience doing investment management roles, such as an analyst, portfolio manager, and the head of a trading desk. He's got these big designations, CFA, Certified Financial Analyst, and CMT, Chartered Market Technical. And I know that those are super hard, so welcome, Matthew. So what we're going to do is I'm going to really quickly, in case you weren't here on the first half, is just kind of recap what we talked about. The topic today is 2024 market review, but then more importantly, looking ahead. So Matthew actually shared with us some insights on, you know, the past performance of our equity markets. Fixed income, I challenged him a little bit on, you know, what do you do now when interest rates are higher again? Do you start locking in some things, you know, because the bonds did rebound? And global markets, I think that was the most interesting part, Matthew, because, you know, as an economy, we're global, and a big part of the United States, 49% you quoted, is involved in international companies, or they're selling their items to international companies. We started to look ahead to 2025, and what do we expect? What are some of the gotchas? Monetary policy, interest rates, you know, we don't really know where they're headed. They try to give us a somewhat good prediction. And then we've got a lot of fiscal things now. We've got a lot of changes. The word tariff in the news every single day. And then also the outlook of just the what ifs. How's the market going to react? So there's some questions. So anyway, we want to take your questions, as Susie said. Mm-hmm. We actually have people that are waiting. Mm-hmm. So Susie, I think we just go with the questions right away.
Okay, let's start with the one we mentioned before we took our break. Texter writes, ask this gentleman about some of the challenges with government challenges in France, Germany, and China's economy. So go ahead with that one, Matt, if you'd like.
Yeah, absolutely. And challenges is certainly challenges of uncertainty is certainly not U.S. specific. You know, what we're seeing is kind of a bit of a sweeping wave globally of more country-specific concern. You know, this turn away from global markets or global economy, and there's creating a little bit of tension within each country how that plays out. And as you mentioned, you know, China has been quite a concern, because China has been one of the strongest growing economies for decades, clearly since 2000. But the past couple of years, we've seen flat growth within China. And it can be attributed to any number of reasons, and depending on what the commentator is looking at. But the fact is, there is pretty well flat growth within China, who was one of the major leaders in economic growth. And given that and what we're seeing, you know, the growth opportunities has shifted a little more back towards domestic, you know, towards U.S. companies. And the fact is, the companies themselves are doing business globally. So instead of, you know, picking a winner as a country in the international emerging markets, it seems like one of the, you know, the better options, or at least what we're seeing, is relying on the companies within the United States to go out into global markets and develop them and grow, you know, their income stream and net income. And Peg, I don't know what you would say about all the uncertainty, but love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, we get a lot of questions from clients about just the things that are globally going on, you know, the war in Ukraine, and things that are lasting a long time. And they seem to be kind of side things that are happening. And it's easy to get kind of just about the United States and the fact that we have done so well in 2024, but there's so many countries out there that are not. I rely on the investment team to coach me as to where to put the money globally, because I don't have time to do all that research, thanks to the Matthew Parks of the world, that entire investment team on our roundtable. That's their specialty, is doing the research and then coaching us as to where we should put our clients in. And it's probably all about diversification. We're not going to pick France or Germany or some independent country like that. We definitely are going to be more diversified. Susie?
651-461-9226. Another texter writes, is there an optimal time to balance your portfolio? Does history indicate the best time during the year to rebalance a stock portfolio?
Matthew?
Yeah. I mean, you can look through the historical average returns by month. And, somewhat outside of September being, you know, historically the worst month of the year for some reason, there's not really any clear signal. There's more noise than there is signal. So what I would tell you is, really, if you're up at night and you're thinking about it, there's a point when you should look at rebalancing and working with an advisor to build a plan that rebalances or reallocates based on rules. And that's really the practice we do. So when I help work with the advisors and clients to build a portfolio, the question on risk is at the start. You know, what would keep you up? What's considered a major move? What are you going to need your cash for? And we have rules in place that if your allocation, your portfolio varies over time from that initially set allocation target, it just gets trimmed and rebalances automatically back to your target. Because it's not so much about timing the rebalance or letting one asset class or, you know, individual holding run in make up the lion's share of your portfolio, but it's about following the initial plan and having a rules and system approach to stay in line with that plan so that there's no point in time you're up at night worrying about an imbalance. What do you think, Peg?
Yeah, I would agree with everything that you said. I've never been a fan of auto rebalancing. Mm-hmm. I've just never been a fan, because what I've always witnessed in my tenure is that when things start to go up, it seems to continue to go up. Like there's this momentum of it going up. And so if I rebalance too quickly, then I feel like I lose out on that momentum that is still there. So what I always have done in my practice is you look at your overall allocation. So let's say you're 50% fixed income and you're 50% in equities. And all of a sudden, equities are not doing well, And so you have a lower percentage in your equities, which then says, oh, let's rebalance. We're now going to buy when it's low versus selling off something at the high. So I've always done the rebalancing at the client's reviews. And if there is a major move, then just proactively call them to say, hey, I think it's time for a rebalance. The other thing I like what you said, Matthew, is given your circumstances. So life is what happens when you're making other plans. That's actually a quote that I copied from supposedly an unknown author, but I've used it for decades, is life is what happens when you're making other plans. Because if something happens in your life and all of a sudden you're exposed to a lot of stock and you can't afford to be anymore, then that may be a rebalance. And maybe it's a rebalance on some given day, but maybe you're going to rebalance over a little bit of time because it's just a dramatic change in your asset allocation. So there's a lot of factors that go into rebalancing. But once again, I've never been a fan of like an automatic rebalancing, just because I feel like asset classes continue to go up for a while versus change every single month. Susie?
Peg, this is a question for both of you. Is it somewhat astonishing that the Dow Jones Industrial Average right now is at 42,840? Is that a huge number to both of you?
Do you want to start with that one?
Do you remember the days when it was 1,200?
I don't remember that, but yeah, it is astounding. And this concept has really came up when inflation was at 9%, because stocks, equities are just valued and quoted in terms of U.S. dollars. The actual price level is a little arbitrary, because what we're looking at is, well, the growth in the money supply, so now there's more dollars. Mm. So the price of the equities would go up, just everything else being equal, if the number of dollars increases. That doesn't even account for the fact that if you look at the growth in wealth over the past 20 years, we're able to do more efficiently with greater scale, and the things that we have are better. You know, I mean, compare the CD player and Walkman that was when I was, you know, at a soccer practice compared to I can stream a million songs. Mm. So there's so much that goes into it. But looking at the, you know, Dow Jones as at a number value, it can sometimes be a little misleading. But yes, it is certainly astonishing. Peg?
So I have a question, Matthew. So we've got the Dow Jones at 30 stocks, and we've got the S&P 500 at 500 stocks. Is there ever going to be a day where they just blend them, or will it just continue to be the way it is?
That's a good question.
I don't think we'd see a blending of the indexes and what you look at to quote the stock market bull. And really what we've seen is clients are now coming and saying the S&P 500. You know, the Dow Jones used to be the indicator or the tracker of the market. But when you have the S&P 500 with the 500 largest companies in the United States, it covers so much more. It's a much better picture of what's happening in the economy and the market as a whole.
Okay. I was going to ask, jump in
well,
here.
That's why I had asked, because yes, the clients are coming in asking about the S&P 500. I don't hear the Dow that much.
Okay.
But
is the S&P gained as much as the Dow has during this time? Peg or Matt?
Matthew, do you have that in front of you?
Yeah. No, I don't have it pulled up, but the rough answer would be no. The Dow Jones has more industrial names, and it's a little more value names. You know, at one time it was Coca-Cola and railroads made up a lion's share.
Okay.
So
more dividend paying stocks, right?
Great performance. Exactly.
More dividend paying stocks, yes, okay. Versus growth.
All right.
Susie, we'll take the next one.
Yeah. This person wrote, a nice gain. I have a nice gain on a stock. If I sell, do I have to wait 30 days before I buy it back?
No. The only time that you would have to do that is if there's a loss. So if you sell a position that has a loss on it and you buy it back within 30 days, it'd be considered a wash sale. In other words, the IRS would not count essentially the losses that you would realize. But you can certainly sell a position that has a gain and take, you know, take some chips off the table or reset your cost basis and purchase it back without any penalty.
Okay.
And could I go buy a similar stock? Because I don't want to be out of the stock market in 30 days. Could I go buy a similar one?
Exactly. Yes. So if you had, say, a loss on Coca-Cola, you could sell it. And if, but if you bought Coca-Cola back right away, you get that wash sale. But you could buy Pepsi. And usually that would be considered a tax loss harvest or an equivalent. We're able to capture those losses, purchase an equivalent with the proceeds. Now, you can even look at that with mutual funds or ETFs because, according to latest guidance from the IRS would be the difference in management between funds would make up the difference and would allow you to purchase roughly something similar, a similar holding, without incurring that wash sale, okay?
Yes. Yeah. So I agree with everything you said. I would check with your financial advisor, or I think we cleared it up here today. It's not too hard to find something that's different. And what a lot of clients say is, oh, well, I don't want to own Pepsi. Well, then let's find something that you'd want to own, or let's take the risk because it could be actually profitable to sit in cash for 30 days. You just don't know. Whenever we have a short time frame like that, it's anyone's guess what direction the market's going to go. And when you talk about an individual stock, that's even more of a risk, I believe, for 30 days of time. Susie?
651-461-9226. You can use that number to call and ask your question directly, or you can use that number to text your question. A texter writes, what is your outlook for real estate investment trusts? I guess that's not really a market question, is it, Peg?
That's a great question.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. 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 So real estate is been kind of swept up in the past, 10, 15 years as the development technology has created far more access to investments that weren't traditionally available to every investor. One of those is real estate investment trust. It's essentially you have ownership in private real estate or publicly traded real estate. And that can look like housing units. That can look like industrial warehouses, office buildings, a blend of them. It does, it can make up any kind. Overall, to answer that question, what kind of REIT or real estate investment trust? Is it diversified? Where is it located? Is it diversified geographically? Overall, falling interest rates is certainly going to be a tailwind, beneficial to the real estate market. One of the concerns that we are seeing in the real estate market is the oversupply of office things, industrial parks, but, not so much having that concern on housing units. So the answer really is going to depend on what is the exposure that you're working with. And running an in-depth analysis more so would be the next step, looking at that. Okay.
Yeah, we always, and I've been in this long enough that we always said stocks, bonds, real estate, and cash. Those were the four kind of diversifiers. When it comes to real estate, is it still true, Matthew, that, because the reason we said bonds, stocks, real estate, and cash is because they didn't move in the same tandem at the same time. And so it was a good diversifier if the stock market wasn't doing well and the bond market wasn't doing well. At least you had kind of this hard asset type of position in your portfolio. Does that still bode today?
To an extent. Now, REITs are publicly traded. So when, the average investor gets scared and wants to sell off or wants to buy one way or the other, they're going to look at these publicly traded REITs, and there's going to be a higher correlation or similarity to stocks. But In the longer time frame, it depends on what the REIT owns. If it's a diversified basket of holdings, we may not see the movement follow the stock market as much. If it's, there's any number of structures that a REIT can look like, and it depends on, the underlying real estate investments in that REIT to determine. Okay.
Yeah, and I would agree, Matthew, that there's so many different types of ways that you can invest in real estate, and it actually has to be kind of coordinated with that particular client, because what happens is some of the things are illiquid or don't have as much liquidity as it would if it traded on the stock exchange. But then the negative of the stock exchange is that they throw in a thing that might be more like stocks than real estate. So I would say work with your advisor, or become educated about your risk in all the different ways of investing in real estate. Susie?
Yes, we have a texter who wonders about, he's an older gentleman, he's 82 and he has $400,000, and he's curious about some advice on putting that somewhere where it's low risk, where it won't go away fast, it'll keep its wealth.
Yeah, when looking at, the pyramid of risk to reward or the scale of risk to reward on assets, it depends on what's your cash flow needs. The old rule of thumb is roughly 4%, cash flow off your asset base. And that varies quite dramatically depending on your allocation and cash flow and age and everything like that. But as far as that conversation would really steer me towards asset classes. So if you're taking a large percentage of the money in cash flow, certainly not equities, and that seems to be what you're saying, so I'd be looking more at, CDs, treasuries, bonds, fixed income. That's where you're going to have a lower risk and a little more guarantee of a return or income.
And Peg?
I would totally agree with Matthew, and I just want to thank Matthew for coming on today. And I think we would have lots of questions if we had another hour that we could spend with him.
Totally. And if you didn't get your question answered, 1-888-1-888-6-ADVICE, 888-6-ADVICE, or yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com, yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Make it a great week.